is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Elbridge Colby, the author of the new book, The Strategy of Denial, American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict. Elbridge Colby is co-founder and principal of the Marathon Initiative. He has served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy and Force Development, 2017 through 2018. And we turn to the condition at hand in the world as we know it. The competition, great power competition, involves the players from the 20th century plus China. And Bridges' book looks at all of those possibilities, but focuses on China. So before we come to the examples of China and the U.S. in conflict in East Asia, we begin with definitions. Bridge, a very good evening to you. Congratulations. A military strategy for limited war. What is limited war, and what does the U.S. now know about its possible opponent, China, in a limited war? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. It's wonderful to be back on with you. It's a pleasure to be back on and an honor. What is a limited war? A limited war is something that sounds paradoxical, but is very actually deeply rooted in basically human nature and certainly military affairs, which is the idea that, you know, even in wars that engage people's, you know, deepest emotions and, you know, aspirations and fears, there are almost always incentives to keep a war from spiraling to the kind of the very worst levels of violence. I mean, World War II is in most respects a total war, but the vast majority of other wars in human history have been limited. You know, whether because of the choice of the participants for some reason or another, because they're pursuing political objectives and they have other interests in the world, or a lack of capacity. In the context of China, there's these kind of old verities of limited war, but there's also a particularly important one, which is that both sides have what's called survivable nuclear arsenals, and in addition to nuclear arsenals, have enormous additional ways of hurting each other. So you essentially have what Tom Schelling famously called, you know, two scorpions in a bottle, right? Which is they can both sting each other. You know, we and the Chinese can hurt each other gravely, you know, under any circumstances, even if we were beating the other in a limited war. But in this context, both sides have a very strong incentive to avoid things getting completely out of hand, because whatever goals they're pursuing in the world will be vitiated by a war become apocalyptic. You know, so the only reason to actually take a step that would initiate an apocalyptic reprisal from your opponent is actually your survival. But the kinds of things that we're talking about and that I talk about in the book are not, for either side, they're not genuinely existential. But that doesn't, you know, that part people often get, but that often leads people to think that, that major powers will never fight wars under the nuclear shadow. But I don't think that's true. That's a sort of a conditional reality. That's a creation of deliberate policy. And that, you know, I mean, if we look back at some of the crises actually of the Cold War, throughout the Cold War, both sides were planning for a war, including in the European theater involving nuclear weapons. There's a famous episode during the Berlin crisis of 1961 where the Soviet Politburo actually talks about the probability of war resulting from some of its aggressive moves on Berlin. Nonetheless, took them forward. So people are willing to do that. But I think this is important because, especially for one reason, if you are totally unprepared for a limited war under the nuclear shadow, so if we, the Americans, are unprepared to countenance a limited war under the nuclear shadow with the Chinese, the Chinese have an enormous amount of room on the table to take stakes off the table, right? Because if they're a little bit more prepared to run that risk, then they will beat us in a standoff, whether that leads to war or not. So we have to be prepared precisely in order to deter that outcome and ultimately to deter a war.
What is striking as I read is that limited wars are rules-based. Limit means, limit ends. And the rules can be set by a third party. What does that mean? Who would set the rules for a third party in history? Can you give an example?
Sure. Well, I think the main point is that they're rules, but small r rules. They're not rules that are enforced by an omnipotent umpire or sovereign, especially in a contest between two superpowers, right? The United States and China are the two most powerful entities in the world. So if we engaged in a conflict, God forbid, it would be only we ourselves who would ultimately be enforcing those rules, and the third parties, which is the weight of potential third party opprobrium, but ultimately the potential for meaningful intervention. And so if you look at it, and this could be indirect and sort of not even the possibility of direct military intervention, but it could be expectations about economic punishment or political loss or something. So if you look, for instance, in Vietnam, we were willing to fight a war and commit large numbers of our forces and wage an air war, a limited air war of North Vietnam. But actually one of the reasons that we did limit that air war over North Vietnam, unfortunately in many respects, and in South Vietnam and, you know, avoid intervening into Laos and Cambodia overtly for much of the war, was actually the prospect of criticism and a weakening of our interests in other parts of the world, for instance, from the Europeans or, say, the Japanese. And so, or the example when there were rumors, after the collapse of the UN position in the early part of the Korean War, there were rumors that Washington was considering the employment of tactical nuclear weapons on the peninsula, and British Prime Minister Clement Attlee made a direct intervention with President Truman not to do it. So in a sense, the way I think about it is it's kind of like a wrestling match, where there's no umpire. But both sides have an interest in not killing each other, basically, or certainly not dying. And so there are going to be some rules. How those rules are set, though, are in a sense a battlefront of their own that requires active strategy.
You also report that in a limited war, there are political ends inside these self-established rules. What does that look like?
Well, I mean, that's a critical point. I mean, a war is limited in its means. You know, if you're unlimited in what you're doing to your opponent, the war can't really be limited. And it's also limited in its ends, because if it's not limited in its ends, the other side has no incentive to constrain its own action against you. So, you know, what those political goals are variable. Korea is also a good example where our goals changed over the course of the conflict. You know, initially it was to eject the communists from South Korea. Then we got arrogant and we decided we were going to try to unify the peninsula. Then we fell back and we went back to the status quo ante. So, you know, which in a sense was a satisfactory outcome if we think about it from our first principles point of view. I think what we're trying to do here in this context is think about what are political objectives, overall strategic objectives that are attainable within the military bounds that we think are plausible and that we can shape in our favor. And I mean, as I discussed in the book, I think those are basically a defense of our particularly our allies within an anti-hegemonic coalition vis-a-vis China and Asia.
Let us use the Vietnam War. You use that as an example throughout this. That was a rules-based in that the U.S. and was against a power, the North Vietnamese, who were nowhere near as powerful. We, the U.S., limited its goals. So it was an asymmetrical war. That's a good example. However, when it comes to the end of the Vietnam War, the North Vietnamese launched an all-out offensive and the U.S. pulled back. Is that an example of a limited war that the more powerful state lost? I'm talking beyond China now to what is possible in a conflict in Asia again.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, the North Vietnam pursued unlimited goals. It did at least obscure those goals at various times enough to either hoodwink us or tell us what we wanted to hear, and it limited its means oftentimes over the course of the war, you know, between the North and the Viet Cong. But at the end of the day, based on the situation as it evolved, they pursued unlimited ends with effectively, in the context, unlimited means. And by that point, we were out of the war. So that, I mean, if you know, from our point of view, is a limited war. Ultimately, from the end of the day, the North Vietnamese didn't regard that. But from our point of view, we need to regard it as a limited war. But, you know, similarly, you could think of, you know, some of the rebellions or insurgencies against colonial powers that might be unlimited from the perspective of the insurgents, but not from the perspective of the colonial power. You know, Algeria would be an example. I mean, it's, in some respects, maybe the American Revolution. Obviously we limited the Americans were limited our side as well. But I mean, this is the, you know, the shadow of Vietnam hangs over my thinking all the time for a variety of reasons, because a lot of these concepts came to grief in the context of Vietnam. I think, I think because of unwise and imprudent application of a lot of the theories that are that are woven into this book. But they were not done by people who were fools. They were very, very intelligent, competent, expert, experienced people. I think, you know, a number of the lessons of Vietnam is that we can't have, we can't think that we can manipulate, foreign decision making in the context of a limited war too sort of adroitly. We can't become overconfident, and we need to remain laser focused on what it is specifically that we need to attain geopolitically and strategically. I think at the end of the day, and people like Hans Morgenthau saw this at the time, Vietnam was not critical to the disposition of the ultimate resolution of the Cold War, even in Asia, certainly not globally. But we lost the bubble on that by not being kind of ruthlessly rigorous in remaining focused on what we needed to attain.
I'm speaking to Elbridge Colby, the author of the new book, The Strategy of Denial, American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict. We're going to turn to the purpose of U.S. strategy and its construction of an anti-China, anti-hegemonic coalition. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.